from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since January, we've talked right here plenty about fears of spillover of Syria's turmoil, about Iraq teetering on civil war. Today, we've got both invasion, uprising, a map changing as fast as you can draw. This hour, On Point, Iraq coming undone and all its implications. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you following the black flags of a would-be new caliphate that calls for U.S. action, U.S. restraint? What are we witnessing here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Baghdad is Ned Parker, Baghdad Bureau Chief for Reuters. Ned, thank you for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
Lots of questions. First, just start at the embassy in the green zone there. Have the Marines arrived? Are the embassy staff, that portion that's going, clearing out?
I wouldn't be able to see it just because all of these movements would be happening very quickly, and the green zone's a very locked down area. But I imagine it's all happening very quickly.
100 Marines were told coming in, and others headed out to other parts of Iraq and out of the country. Ned, what's the talk in Baghdad over this weekend? Do Baghdadis see Iraq holding together, or do they are they ready to fight to the furthest border to hold it together, or do they see it coming apart?
I think it depends what kind of Iraqi you're talking to. The Kurds in the north are elated, thrilled. In one of our Reuters stories, we quoted a Kurdish person saying, official saying, ISIL Daesh was able to give us in 2 weeks what Maliki hasn't been able to give us in 8 years. And that's the key thing. The Kurds are very much interested in independence. I think Kurdish officials will tell you in private that, for the most part, with some very limited exceptions, that they no longer really care about a state of Iraq working. They're interested in finding the way to break away, knowing that it won't happen tomorrow and it's something they have to keep working towards. So developments there were huge for the Kurds. In the Sunni parts of Iraq, you hear accounts of people in a place like Mosul saying that the treatment they're getting from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant and other groups like Naqshbandi, which is basically a Ba'athist formation headed by Ezzat Ibrahim al-Dori, a deputy to Saddam Hussein, they're sort of administering Mosul together with other former military officers and angry tribesmen. It's a mix. It's not just the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, but Sunnis there will say to a point that it's better life now than under the Iraqi security forces of Prime Minister Maliki. But I don't think that would be all Sunnis. I think many Sunnis in these areas of Saladin and Nineveh are terrified by these armed groups that are going around and clearly long for stability. Inside Baghdad, most people are shocked and stunned. They don't know what's happening. They're terrified. I think, sincerely, ordinary Iraqis, whatever of their stripe in terms of sectarian or ethnic identity, are truly worried about the future of the country and what could happen.
Here was the Grand Ayatollah, this is Ali al-Sistani, on Friday, urging people, the militia, to fight back against the militants. A sheikh delivering his message there, saying, we call on all citizens who can carry weapons and fight the terrorists in defense of their country, its people, and its holy sites, to volunteer and join the security forces to fulfill this sacred goal. Ned Parker, you're there in Baghdad. The next day, the Grand Ayatollah came out and said, please use maximum restraint in your neighborhoods if you're mixed Sunni and Shia. Is there evidence of a Shia militia coming out and between the country's official army, which the U.S. has spent billions helping to buck up, and the militia, do they appear to have the capacity, the coherence, the leadership to effectively push back?
Right. I mean, you've raised all these points, and it was Grand Ayatollah Sistani's representative who spoke on Friday in Karbala. Mm-hmm. And as you said, in describing what was said, he was telling them to join the security forces. I mean, Sistani has always been the voice of restraint and a figure respected across the board in Iraq as a moderate. And during the civil war of 2005, 2006, 2007, he never called for Shia to stand up and pick up arms to join with the army. To have him make that call for civilians to stand up and join the fight, even though he was telling them to join the security forces and to act with maximum restraint. And someone who met with Sistani in Najaf, I believe, explained that Sistani was very unhappy with the way his words were interpreted. They were given a more of an extreme twist than what was meant. But the fact that he said those words just show how dire the situation is today. The fact that he never would have said that before during a time that was quite dark several years ago, but he's saying it now shows the existential threat that Iraqi Shia feel they are under. And for that part, all Iraqis. I think all Iraqis feel they are under threat by the forces tearing their country apart now. Certainly, there's not going to be real stability from this for some time. But when we talk about can the Iraqi army push them back, I would add, and Reuters has reported, the militias, we're not talking about the volunteers that have been coming forward to recruitment stations now, who are being shown on Iraqi state television all the time, signing up tribesmen, young men, posing with their guns to sign up to fight alongside the army against the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. But the militias have been activated in Iraq since the beginning of the year. Groups like Asab al-Haq and Kitab Hezbollah, technically their members have been activated to fight as so-called Sons of Iraq, the term that was used for fighting al-Qaeda by the Sunni tribes, because the army has been so weak already in places like Anbar and around the perimeter of Baghdad. So I think the prime minister and those around him made the strategic choice that they needed guerrillas to fight guerrillas, but it's been very messy and ugly, and civilians have died in this around the edges of Baghdad in rural areas. So the use of a civilian volunteer force to fight alongside the army potentially could work. It's very dangerous because it's an admission that the institution of the army has not worked well, and the prime minister now has to draw upon sectarian identity to reassert stability in the country. And then when we look at the performance of members of Asab al-Haq and Kitab Hezbollah and others who have been fighting under a Iraqi government chain of command as quoting...
We're losing Ned Parker in Baghdad right there. Ned Parker, thank you so much for joining us. Sorry to lose you, but the connections get rough to Baghdad sometimes. We've got tape here. Dozens of men in Sadr City, Shiite neighborhood in Baghdad, marching through the streets. Looks like over the weekend, waving guns and flags, saying they're ready to fight. This with the Grand Ayatollah's call for Iraqi Shia to take up arms. Of course, in the Northwest, and well beyond at this point, a very different message. Here was a video showing a sea of smartphones in a nighttime rally filming a commander of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, a commander in mask, full vest of gun clips. You'll hear his message. He says, we've defeated the Americans and their allies, and the crowds shout, Allah Akbar, God willing, will establish a state ruled by the Quran. A lot of talk about a caliphate there, as they've spilled over from Syria, as others have risen up to meet, greet, be with them in Iraq, in the Sunni areas in particular. With us right now from Cairo is Borzu Dargahi, correspondent for the Financial Times. He's covered Iraq and the region for many years. Borzu, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
And from Washington, Seth Jones joins us, acting director of the RAND Corporation's International Security and Defense Policy Center. Lots of talk in Washington about what's going on here. Seth Jones, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Borzu, what is your sense at this point of the mix of fighters who have taken all of this terrain, at least a bunch of cities now, from central government control? How much has come out of Syria? How much are local Sunni tribal leaders and tribesmen? How much is former Saddamists joining in this takeover?
Well, the numbers aren't clear. The former Saudi director of intelligence, Faisal al-Turki, estimated that there were no more than 3,000 ISIS fighters, no more than 3,000 from Daesh, and that the rest of the forces were what I would call legacy insurgent groups. Islamist and Ba'athist and nationalist groups that were born out of the U.S. occupation and the subsequent conflict between Sunni insurgent groups and the Iraqi government. Now, those groups calmed down a little bit during the last years of the U.S. presence from like 2008 to 2011, as it appeared that Iraq was on the right track. But because in part of the Maliki government's missteps, its perceived sectarianism, its incompetence, those groups had risen up again. They were active in Anbar province very much so. They were never really inactive in Mosul, but they managed to take advantage of the ISIS juggernaut and reemerge from the shadows and establish control, in, from what I understand, in partnership with ISIS, at least for now.
Seth Jones, you know, before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the talk about a caliphate rising there was in very marginal zones sounded kind of nutty. Do we now see a new political entity straddling borders, destroying old countries, at least as we understood them? Is that a real possibility? Is it happening, Seth?
Well, I think at this point what we do see is the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which does have an objective of establishing an extreme version of a caliphate or an emirate, really, across parts of not just Iraq but the broader Levant, al-Sham, into Syria and potentially into other states such as Jordan. But I think as Ned, Borsu, and others have noted, I think the media has in some cases overstated who's involved in this. I mean, right now we do have the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, but we have a number of other Sunni groups which have objectives that are not to establish a caliphate.
Seth Jones, hold that thought if you'd be kind enough. We really want to dive in on that point and more. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about Iraq coming undone. Here's the sound of video posted last week showing ISIS militants in the streets of Tikrit. We're looking at cities falling, fighters on the move, massacre scenes, and where it all goes with Seth Jones from the RAND Corporation, the International Security and Defense Policy Center there, joining us from Washington. Borzu Dargahi, who's covered this region for years, joining us today from Cairo. Plenty of hot explanations over the weekend. Yesterday on Fox News Sunday, House Intelligence Committee Chair Republican Mike Rogers, Michigan, critical of President Obama's call for the Iraqi government to solve the crisis with sectarian fence mending.
It's too late to have long political reconciliation meetings that will last weeks or months to try to get through even the finest points of difference. You have an al-Qaeda army on the move. This isn't just Sunnis versus Shias. This is an al-Qaeda-minded group that is using all of the tactics of brutality to subdue Mosul and Tikrit and other places. This is as dangerous as it gets.
But the president saying on Friday, we can't do it for them.
We can't do it for them. And in the absence of this type of political effort, short-term military action, including any assistance we might provide, won't succeed.
He wants the Maliki government to reach out and try and make up here. Seth Jones in Washington, are you suggesting that what we're seeing is self-correcting, that the Saddamists among these black-clad fighters and the Iraqi tribal leaders would push back against the caliphate idea? What would they push for then, Seth?
Well, I think what we've seen is there's a broad range of groups here. There is the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant's and its efforts to establish a caliphate. But there are a number of Sunni nationalist groups involved in the fighting, such as the Islamic Army of Iraq, the Naqshbandis that Ned mentioned earlier, and other groups like the Muslim Brotherhood's 1920 Revolutionary Brigades. These groups have different long-term objectives, but I think what unites many of them and what the U.S. has to be very careful, and I think the U.S. president is somewhat in tune to this, is that they've tapped into deep-rooted Sunni alienation, particularly against the Maliki government. And so I think any U.S. efforts to consider providing assistance or even conducting airstrikes has got to think through what political changes must take place within the Iraqi government.
Though we hear Mike Rogers right there saying, too late. It's kind of game on here, though it's never too late. But let's hear from our listeners, Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks. The Sykes-Picot agreement that drew these lines is an illusion. It's an illusion. We fought 10 years to keep this 100-year-old illusion alive. We have to empower Anbar province. We have to create nation states out of whole cloth again. We have to end this illusion.
What are you saying, Stephen? Let Syria as we've known it, let Iraq as we've known it, dissolve?
Let it dissolve. That's the only way we'll be able to save Damascus and Baghdad. Let this dissolve. Let's empower the Sunni nation.
Stephen, thank you for your call. Borzu Dargahi, can you see that happening? Can you see the powers that be with the interests that are looking out over this region of turmoil and saying, hey, those borders are gone. We need something new here. Can you see it, Borzu?
You know, in this day and age, redrawing borders is not a very easy thing to do. You need to have at least the backing of one or more superpowers to do it. And I don't see that as a potential for happening. But in this case, when you have the group ISIS has declared that it's not content to just take over Mosul and Tikrit and Sunni areas. It has made a call to attack the Shia shrine cities of Najaf and Karbala. So their ambitions go beyond just taking over the Sunni parts of the country. They're launching what appears to be a very intense and very extreme sectarian war against the Shia. So I'm not sure if that would work. I'm not sure if anyone would tolerate a Sunni statelet dominated by this particular group in this particular situation, whether the Americans would tolerate it, the Iranians, the Iraqi Shia. I don't think anyone would tolerate it.
But you say the U.S. wouldn't tolerate it, but the U.S. seems very reluctant to really go back in there. We've got an aircraft carrier, an amphibious craft now in the area, but I mean, we all watched how difficult it was in Fallujah and beyond to push insurgents out before Borzu. It cost a lot. It cost maybe trillions. It cost thousands of U.S. lives, and it only lasted a few years, it turns out here. What do you mean by won't tolerate?
I think there's other ways to stop the juggernaut than sending troops in. I think that one possibility, and maybe it's even likely at this point, is either airstrikes or drone strikes on ISIS positions. Another possibility is that the U.S. will give certain tools to the Iraqi government to help them stamp out this menace, really, to the region and the world. But I think even beyond that, what you see happening right now, and in a way it's a worst-case scenario, but it's you know, very cynically a tolerable scenario for much of the world, is that there won't be any Sunni state established. There won't be a peace established, that this current situation will fester for months and maybe even years, as it has in Syria, where you have extreme armed groups fighting a central government that is also rather extreme and harsh. And I think that's the worst case scenario for Iraqi and even Syrian civilians. It's the worst-case scenario for the region, but in a way, it's sadly the most likely scenario.
Seth Jones, comment on that. No greater threat here or menace to the region, the world. Americans have heard a lot of contrary talk to that. Over the weekend, we heard Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican South Carolina. This was on CBS Face the Nation. Listen to how he describes the possible likely impact of what's going on here.
They will eventually march on Jordan and Lebanon. Our best ally in the region is the King of Jordan. And they will attack us from that part of Iraq and Syria, according to our own national director of national intelligence, FBI director. The next 9/11 is coming from here.
Seth Jones, no threat to the region, to the world, or, you know, terrible threat to the region and the world?
Oh, I think without a doubt, this is a growing threat to the United States, the region, and certainly important parts of the world. And, you know, this is more, and Senator Graham noted, this is more than just an Iraq threat. The primary group involved in the surge right now, though not the only one, is the Islamic State of Iraq in Levant, or ISIS, as it's often known. And two things that are worth noting. One is we've had American at least one American suicide bomber now blow himself up from Florida in Syria recently. We've also now had assassinations in Europe. We had one in Brussels a couple of weeks ago from someone who had been trained by the same organization, ISIL, in Syria. So there is a growing threat by several of these Salafi jihadist groups to stability, not just in the region, but also into Europe and connections now to a foreign fighter flow in the United States. I think if the United States does not get more involved, at least in the clandestine, covert side of this, that the situation is likely to get much worse rather than is better. I think that's got very serious implications for U.S. interests in the region.
Lots of foreigners have flowed into Syria and joined the fight there from Europe, from the United States. Some number of them will eventually flow home, and they everybody's saying here at that point they'll be hardened and skilled fighters. It was easy over the weekend to see the language coming out of ISIS leaders and others. You know, we will take this to you. We'll take this to New York. And you've got people in the U.S. quite ready to respond to that. Others saying, let's keep cool here. Aaron in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi. My question was just with ISIS, what is their end game? What's their political agenda? Where in 5 years and 10 years do they want to be, and with what results?
Aaron, I appreciate your call. Borzu, can we just define some terms here, because it gets confusing? There's ISIS. The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. People also say Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, which is that eastern end of the Mediterranean, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, on into parts of Iraq. People talk about Daesh, which I guess these are both interpretations of that same thing here. Can you outline a political agenda that is clear, Borzu? Is it fixed?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Syrian city of Raqqa, where they have been dominant now for about a year or more, you can see their agenda, which is executing so-called heretics, that is anyone who doesn't subscribe to the same brand of Sunni Islam as they do, forcing women to wear the niqab, the all-face-covering hijab, outlawing smoking and drinking with the punishment of death or dismemberment or at least a whipping. So they're basically practicing a very, I guess it's sort of like the Taliban, you know, their sort of vision. It's that same school of thought.
But that sounds like a social vision. I know it has political ramifications. What about the geopolitical vision?
I think absolutely. They are very anti-American. They talk about, but I think that their priority before they would hit the U.S. or the West or anything like that, their priority would be what the jihadis call the near abroad, the sort of the close jihad, the near jihad would be their priority. And they would hit Saudi Arabia and Jordan and perhaps Lebanon and maybe Iran, and though that would be a line to cross for them a little bit, before they would consider the West as a geopolitical agenda.
Lots of talk about the U.S. and Iran perhaps suddenly sharing interests here in tamping some of this down. Borzu Dargahi in Cairo, Seth Jones in Washington, please stand by. Paul Pillar joins us right now, professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program, former National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, former Deputy Director of the CIA's Counter-Terrorist Center. Paul Pillar, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
Headline on your recent essay said, everyone should take a deep breath. Is this not as alarming as it looks somehow? Tell us.
Well, I think Borzu spoke a very important truth just a moment ago, Tom, mm-hmm. and that was that this is not a group that has at the top of its priority, you know, marching across Jordan and then sailing across the Atlantic and hitting the United States. They are locally focused. We should remember that the main basis for the falling out between this ISIS group and al-Qaeda, and even before mm-hmm. that, the predecessor to the ISIS group led by Zarqawi, the al-Qaeda in Iraq, and its falling out with al-Qaeda Central, was precisely over this ideological question that Zarqawi and now the ISIS people are more interested in beheading Iraqi Shia rather than going against the far enemy, namely us, which was what bin Laden's ideology was all about. So I think that's where we have to take a deep breath. These are people who want to establish the kind of social and political milieu that Borzu described in their local area. We do have the problem that Seth described about individual radicalized individuals, but you know, we've been dealing with that for some time. That's not a threat from the group per se.
So do you agree with the vision of this that sees this turmoil dissolving boundaries, maybe Syria's boundaries, redrawing Syria, maybe Iraq's redrawing, shrinking Iraq, maybe creating some new entity that straddles that and maybe more, and you're saying that's okay?
I don't see boundaries being dissolving, and when the Sykes-Picot boundaries have been around for a century, it's more than just a myth, whether we like it or mm-hmm. not. I think we do need to think in terms, and those who are who have Mr. Maliki's ear ought to think in terms of a decentralization, further decentralization of power in Iraq, you know, with the exception of the Kurds, who have enjoyed their autonomous status in the north of the country. Mr. Maliki has really centralized power and control in a very narrow way, and we see part of the result in Anbar and Nineveh today, where the opposition to the regime goes far beyond ISIS, and we have all these other groups that were described earlier that are quite unhappy about how governance in Baghdad works.
Wow. Seth Jones, look at this with us. Do you see the possibility here to move to a calm, decentralized power Iraq? Can ISIS be put back in the bottle? Do you think the Saddamists and the tribal leaders there in the Sunni regions of Iraq are going to turn on ISIS and say, forget about it once again, as they did with a lot of American support some years ago now? Or, I mean, that's not the way it looks in the last week. It looks like black-clad guys on the move.
Yeah, Tom, it's a great question. I think, again, ISIS's broader objective that Barzu and Paul noted earlier, that emirate objective or even broader caliphate objective is not shared by many Iraqis. So I think at some point, and it's hard to predict when, ISIS will get pushed back. The bigger challenge for Iraq, though, are at least two aspects. One is there is still deep-rooted Sunni alienation. There are a number of groups, as we've noted earlier, that support at least overthrowing the Maliki government that presents a challenge to the state. There's also a number of sub-state actors from the Kurds, including the Peshmerga that we've now seen on the streets, protecting Kurdish interests, Shia militia groups. The Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr announced in mid-June the formation of his own units to defend holy sites. So there is a broader challenge of a range of sub-state actors increasingly taking control of neighborhoods, parts of cities, and then rural parts of the country. And in a sense, this potentially contributes to state breakdown. That's of concern.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Barzu, with all of that, defending the holy sites, you could still divide. You could divide the holy sites and still, I mean, you could protect them, defend them, keep them in Shia hands and still divide Iraq quite profoundly, Sunni, Kurdish, Shia, Barzu.
Two things. I mean, first of all, this is one of the things that the more moderate Sunni political leaders have been agitating for a while. They've wanted their own Sunni regional government on the model of the Kurdistan regional government that has been in operation now for 23 years, the KRG, and is a sort of model of success. And they've pointed to that and said that we want that kind of thing. And the Maliki government has not acceded to that demand. And the second thing is, again, I don't see the greatest likelihood I see in terms of what's happening in Iraq is actually the worst case scenario, is that this is just going to continue for some time, that you're going to have this back and forth stalemate, this sort of bloodshed going on for some time. And the greatest danger to the Sunni community is that they don't defeat ISIS and that ISIS sort of absorbs some of the Islamist insurgent groups, takes control of the community with the million, some say more than $1 billion that it's amassed in resources and funds and weapons, and then crushes the more nationalist elements that are much weaker at this point.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Iraq coming apart at the seams in the last week with Barzu Dargahi with the Financial Times joining us from Cairo in Egypt, Seth Jones with the RAND Corporation joining us in Washington, Paul Pillar at Georgetown University there, former deputy director of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center. If you were anywhere in northwest Iraq, you've had some week lately. Lots of people on the move, lots of money, gold, bullion, cash on the move taken by the ISIS coming in from Syria right there in Mosul. Interview Saturday with the BBC in Arabic. An Iraqi woman in a refugee camp outside Mosul described her fear of the ISIS fighters. We're afraid, we are very afraid of them, that they would surprise us with an attack, slaughter us. We fear everything from them. These people have no mercy. So we got out. Of course, lots of people afraid of Baghdad or the United States, counterattack as well, and bombs from up above. Paul Pillar, my question about bringing some restored order here is, who's going to do it? And that doesn't look easy. Baghdad has appeared completely ineffectual. Its military, which we trained at great expense, just dissolved, at least up on this front. ISIS reportedly, the BBC this morning says they have $2 billion now at their disposal, including almost half a billion they scooped up in Mosul. They clearly have backers beyond, and they've got Syria at their back where they can retreat into a land of turmoil where nobody's got a handle on them. How do you bring order to a situation like that, Paul?
Well, first of all, in the near term, what we have, we have a number of things going on, but one of the main things is a sectarian civil war, or a resumption of the sectarian civil war that burst out, you know, some 8 years or so ago. And we ought to, first of all, remind ourselves that in Iraq, we have a country that's estimated to be about 60% Shia Arab, about 20% Sunni Arab, and the other 20% Kurds. So if it comes to a all-out, drag-out, everyone mobilize their militias kind of civil war, the Shia are going to prevail. Now, that's obviously
even without
not
the United States?
Through sheer numbers, if nothing else, yes.
And will they fight and die in big numbers to go back into Anbar province and all the way to Mosul? Is it that important to Baghdad? Their army was not willing to do that just days ago.
Well, the main priority that we're hearing from the mobilizing Shia is to protect Baghdad and make sure there aren't further inroads. But that obviously is not a long-term solution anyway. It gets back to the issue of political inclusiveness and governance. And here, if we're talking about outside influence and what the United States and others can do, this is one where the U.S. and Iran are the two outside governments that are most important for Mr. Maliki and his future in terms of where his aid comes from. And who he's associated with. And you just hinted at this earlier in the show, Tom, but we really do have a major convergence of interests right now between the United States and Iran in trying to stop ISIS. So, you know, one of the bits of policy advice I'd give the administration, I expect they may be following it already, is to coordinate messages with the Iranians in terms of what they are saying to Mr. Maliki. And the main message has to be, you're going to have to change your way of governing unless you want to face this kind of Sunni radicalization at your doorstep forever.
We heard a lot of that kind of talk in the last few days. Just earlier today, we had Secretary of State John Kerry sitting down with Yahoo News global anchor Katie Couric now. Here he is talking about the Obama administration. She asked, would they reach out to Iran?
We're open to discussions if there's something constructive that can be contributed by Iran, if Iran is prepared to do something that is going to respect the integrity and sovereignty of Iraq and the ability of the government to reform.
And South Carolina's Lindsey Graham over the weekend saying, well, okay, but be careful.
We need to all make sure Baghdad doesn't fall. So, yes, we need a dialogue of some kind with the Iranians, but we also need to put them on notice. Don't use this crisis as a way to create a satellite state of Iraq controlled by Iran.
Seth Jones, Iraq's central government under Maliki has been so sectarian and so apparently ineffectual in its security arrangements. I mean, do you feel confident that even with the pressure and backing of Iran and the United States, we have in Iraq a central government that can put the Humpty Dumpty back together here?
Well, I think it may be possible to at least partially put the Humpty Dumpty back together, to use your words, Tom. But I think the question is whether that individual is Maliki. And I think there is a vigorous debate that is ongoing about the future leadership of Iraq, including its key power ministries. I would also add that in addition to political objectives, I do think the U.S. has got to look very carefully at both covert kinds of activities that it is, and then third, our military objectives. And while I'm a little cautious on the use of military strikes, I would forcibly argue that the U.S. should strongly consider efforts to conduct what it calls foreign internal defense, and that is training, equipping, and advising Iraqi security forces on the ground, and that is without engagement more broadly.
Let me go to Mohan, calling from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Mohan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Yes.
I have a question. What role, if at all, is being played by Saudi Arabia as well as the countries in the Gulf in the turmoil that's going on currently in Iraq?
Very good question. Borzu Dargahi, let me come to you. I mean, we've talked about Iran. They, of course, support Assad in Syria, who has fought bitterly with ISIS. And, of course, they support Maliki in Baghdad. But what about Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, their role now, how they're looking at what's unfolding, Borzu?
Well, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states have for years supported their Sunni co-religionists in various degrees and in various formations throughout Iraq in the political game. There are supplied weapons to insurgents. Individuals, even some princes, members of the royal families of these countries, have allegedly been giving support to some very extreme groups as well. None of this is official. I think the Saudis, more than anyone, know the danger of this kind of blowback as they've tried to ride the wave of the Arab Spring and the tumult that has caused. They've realized the danger of supporting very extreme elements within these countries. So I think that they play a very ambiguous role, but I think in general, the most destructive role that Saudi Arabia in particular has played has been its refusal to acknowledge the Maliki government. This has fed into the Maliki government's paranoia and worst tendencies. Maliki has tried repeatedly to reach out to Saudi Arabia as well as to Turkey and the other Gulf states, and he's been rejected. He's been Shia-led Iraq has not been embraced by the rest of the Arab world, and this has been very damaging to the psyche of Iraq's Shia leaders. They feel rejected and they feel on the defensive in relation to the rest of the Arab world, of which they were part, and feel themselves a part. And that has heightened the sectarian elements of the Maliki government.
Perhaps in response, though, it seems he's had plenty of that kind of instinct in the first place. Bob in Bloomington, Indiana. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I hear you guys talk about sectarian solutions, not sectarian solutions, but secular solutions to this war. Well, it seems to me that the people fighting this war are doing it because it's their holy war. God called on them to do this. Who's paying attention to God telling them to put down their arms? I mean, are there imams and mullahs that are trying to bring about a different message? And what do your experts have on that? Like, do they know anything about, you know, with that type of message?
Seth Jones, take us in as far as you can to ISIS and this point of ideology. Who knows? I don't know what's driving them most at this point. I mean, they're taking territory. That's intoxicating in its own terms. And $500 million out of the central bank in Mosul, or perhaps that's kind of intoxicating as well. What about their ideology, where it hits religion, and is there a chance to ameliorate on that front, Seth?
Well, the challenge right now is that we've had the Islamic State of Iraq push forward into multiple cities. Mosul, it's now in the vicinity of Baghdad. It looks, for example, like there are efforts underway to try to attack Taji prison to release Islamic State of Iraq prisoners. But they are motivated, as we have noted, by an extremist ideology to establish a broader emirate under Sharia. The challenge obviously comes because in response we've seen al-Sistani, who called for the Shia to defend religious sites in 2006, issued a statement citing the threat to Baghdad and calling on his followers and others to join the security forces. So there's a Shia response. And then on 13th of June, Iraqi Grand Mufti also called on Iraqis to cooperate with Sunni insurgents. So there is an ideological dimension to this. It's an important one. But the challenge at this point is each of the individual components, and this is a complex set, has its own interests and its own ideological and nationalist views. And And unfurling all of that is where we're is going to be the problem, I think, of any future Iraqi government and any U.S. and other backing for it right now. But it's a very complex combination of these factors that I think makes this situation so difficult.
Very challenging when they're on a roll. And as you say, we don't even know where that roll will end at this point. Abbas in Milwaukee. Abbas, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
So as an Iraqi-born and a U.S. citizen and a U.S. soldier, I do believe that we pulled out the troop too soon, and I do believe that we should go back on ground, and we should free Iraq, help them, and we should stay there just like we have bases in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia.
Abbas, what could we do in more years on the ground there that we now that we could not do in all those years before?
We don't have once we help Iraq get rid of ISIS, we can just stay there, no patrols in the streets, nothing, just like we have in Kuwait. But if we don't stay, Iran is going to take over. They do have plans to turn Iraq into an Islamic Shia state as well. And if Iraq sides with them, they're going to side with Russia, and then all the $8 trillion that we spend, the 5,000 soldier plus that we lost, is going to go for nothing. We have interest in Iraq. Iraq should be ours, not theirs.
Abbas, I appreciate your call. We're looking at Iraq right now. Paul, what about Iran's long-term game plan here? I mean, they've kept Assad in power. He's not out, but he's lost a lot of turf there. Do they really have the capacity to come in here and make this entire thing their satellite, even with this new germ that's planted there straddling the border?
You mentioned Assad. We're talking about Iraq.
Yes, but we're also talking about Syria, where sure. Iran supports Assad, and he's been under terrible pressure. That's the seedbed that this turmoil blew up out of in the last few days.
Well, you've got a couple of different sets of motivations when we discuss these two countries as far as Iran's perspective is concerned. The alliance with the Assads, plural, in Syria over all these years has been more of a marriage of convenience, which was stimulated most of all by the common opposition to the former Ba'athist regime in Iraq, which, of course, is no longer around. The Iranians also have strong equity in their client Hezbollah in Lebanon and everything that implies in terms of supply lines in Syria and so on. In Iraq, I think I would describe the primary Iranian objective this way, and that is to recall that in 1980, Saddam Hussein committed an act of aggression by starting what became the 8-year-long Iran-Iraq War, an incredibly bloody conflict in which, by most estimates, hundreds of thousands of Iranians lost their lives. The Iranians, most of all, do not want a repeat of anything like that. They do not want a return to that sort of Iraqi aggressiveness. And I think that's a goal that we can say we share with them.
Sam in Norwich, Vermont. Sam, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Well, I had a long question, but you have like 2 seconds. The cynic in me can't help but wonder, with your guests in the RAND Corporation and all this kind of Lindsey Graham equating this to 9/11, and
yep.
If all else fails in the United States, we got to invoke 9/11, whether Raytheon and General Dynamics might have some new kit that they need to try out, because this is just nonsense, and it's not our war, and every time the United States public says, you know what, we're war-weary, we hear Lindsey Graham and Barack Obama say, we understand you, but this is different, we need to do this, and I can't help but wonder when the United States public will say, you know what, no. It's enough's enough. And, this is clearly one of those events where, everyone's looking to us, but we've got to turn a blind eye because we just lost too much.
Sam, I've got our time is short, but we hear very clearly the deep distaste for anything like going back in there. I mean, Seth Jones, the idea of a caliphate seemed crazy a decade ago. After the U.S. invasion, it seems less crazy. In fact, you can look at maps that are drawing it all over the place right now. What about a U.S. role here that's anything other than very removed? Do you see American public support for that after all the death and cost already invested here? Can the U.S. turn a blind eye, Seth?
Well, I think the question that any American president has to ask is, what is the U.S. interest, if any, here? And the concern that I have is twofold. One is this is a country in the heart of the Middle East. But also the bloodshed we're seeing in Iraq is part of a regional struggle, not just within Iraq but in Syria, bloodshed in Lebanon. The Jordanians are obviously strongly concerned. We've had the Director of National Intelligence express concern about radicalization in Europe and the United States and foreign fighters, including a suicide bomber from Florida headed to this region that blew himself up recently. So I think the U.S. does have an interest. I would say in response to Sam, though, that I don't think – I'm not calling – I think most Americans are not calling at this point for U.S. ground forces to engage the way they did in 2003. But that doesn't mean the U.S. shouldn't potentially get involved in preventing an overthrow of the Iraqi government. And it's, I don't think it's close to this at this point, but by these Salafi jihadists and others that perceive America in general as a threat. And I do think there are some things the U.S. can do, which I outlined earlier, that get into basic train, advise, and assist missions. But Sam has put his finger, I think, on what is probably the crux of the debate right now.
Boy, we've got Ryan Crocker, former U.S. ambassador there, saying he would support very carefully targeted airstrikes. But Richard Haass, President Council on Foreign Affairs, saying the idea of Iraq that's a united, functioning country, says, I think that's essentially over. This turmoil by no means at an end. Lots of dynamics still to play out. We will follow them. We appreciate this this look in along the way. Seth Jones at the International Security and Defense Policy Center, RAND Corporation in Washington. Seth, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thanks, Tom.
Paul Piller at George Washington University's Security Studies Program. Paul, thank you for your time and insights.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Borzu Dargahi with the Financial Times in Cairo. As always, Borzu, stay safe and thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.